All right, welcome everyone. So my name is Alex Turner. I'm the program manager for the VB and C# compilers at Microsoft. And I'm here today to talk about just general tips and tricks that'll make your life a whole lot easier inside Visual Studio. It's one of those things where we get lots of feedback all the time about the IDE. We're constantly figuring out what features to add, what features to improve. And you know, a lot of times, things people will ask for will be things that we already have or things that we thought we did right, and we're always looking for what we can fix. And so a good way to help improve productivity is often just to go take a look at what's out there and what we're using and what we can be using that we're not yet doing. And so really sort of my goal here for this session is to sort of be clippy for all you guys. Show you the stuff that maybe has been there the whole time that you haven't seen, and also some of the new stuff that's coming in Visual Studio 11 as part of the developer preview. Some of the stuff you can try out now. That's the version we'll be using here. And so really the whole idea of this talk is to have sort of over an hour of content jam-packed full of tips and tricks. We're going to burn through a bunch of different sections here. And I'm going to be showing you stuff in multiple languages. You're going to see features that apply to C# and Visual Basic. We're going to start off with some C++, showing some of the new IntelliSense stuff that's going on there. As I said, some of the features are there already in VS 2010. You know, half the session is about just discovering what's already there for you. But half of it's also about talking about what's new, the kind of stuff that's coming out in VS 11 that'll be able to take that productivity to the next level. And, you know, we've done these kind of sessions before. We often, like, we'll pick our own favorite things that we like here and there from the product. What we did this time, we actually went around to the VS team, walked around the floor and asked people what their favorite features were that they used in the IDE, what made them productive using VS to code VS. And they sort of gave us that. We gathered it and put it together into what you're going to see here. So it's a lot of really cool things that just help us out in our daily lives. And so if you look at the kind of stuff we're going to go through, we're really going to just start off with this basic idea, just the fundamental editor kind of features. Like, what do we add that's going to let you write your code easier and navigate, walk through your code? Then you're going to talk about like just general managing your environment kind of stuff. There's a lot of window management things that we did to sort of support multi-monitor in VS 2010, and we really took that to another level in VS 11, so all the kind of stuff you can do there for people who have 2-3 monitors. And then the idea of search and find, right? Before I was preparing for this talk, I don't think I had a real good idea of how VS considered search and find to be two different things. But if you look inside the IDE, we actually do call out these two separate concepts, and actually you'll get to see what that's all about. VS 11 is making a big bet in this idea of search within the IDE in a big way. And really, we're going to end on something really important, which is efficient debugging. You think of how much time you actually spend debugging code versus writing it, and you can get a lot of bang for your buck if you're getting better at doing things in the IDE while you're actually debugging your code. So with that, that's sort of the last slide, so it's all going to be demo from this point out. The one thing is don't worry about taking notes. So the slides after this, as part of the deck that you'll be able to get later, are going to have all the keyboard shortcuts and things that I show you today. So just worry about figuring out what you like the best and remember that, and then you'll be able to look this all up later. So I'm going to go out back to Visual Studio now, and we'll start with this C++ demo first. And some of the cool stuff that's coming in C++ this time around IntelliSense is bringing some of the benefits from the C# and the Visual Basic approach to slightly more aggressive IntelliSense over to C++. For example, let's just start off here. We're going to do a really simple console app here. All it's going to do is take in the list of arguments and print them back out to the console. Nothing really fancy. And you see that as I start typing here, I'm just typing C string, I'm going out, and as I'm typing, I'm already getting this kind of IntelliSense here. So it's coming up. I didn't have to invoke it and push Control J or Control Space or anything. It's coming up for me. But you notice if I was to just hit space, it's not overly aggressive. It's not going to start auto-completing. It's going to let me type things that aren't there yet. But I have that list popping up, and I'm able to just hit space, or when I actually use Control Space to invoke it, or hit Tab otherwise to actually pull that out. So I've hit Tab to complete it, so I have C string here. I'm going to make header. And I'm just going to output this first thing that says how many parameters there are, or how many arguments there are to the program. So I'm going to say here, header dot. And you see, all right, well, here's the list of things that I have inside header. And so now C++ is going to get one of the other benefits that we had from VS 2010, where we say, all right, header dot, now I want to maybe get something that has char in the name. When I write char, though, like it's finding char to OEM A, but it's also finding other methods that happen to have char within them. It's doing this kind of substring search. And you think of this kind of thing. This is something you can play with today, C# and VB. And you go and imagine using WinForms or WPF. And you know, hey, I want to get the height of this. But is it called height? Maybe it's called height. Maybe that's the property that I want. But it could also be called control height or row height or something. And it's very often you know one word that's probably in what you're looking for, but it could be in the middle. And this turns out to be a lifesaver when you're just navigating through unfamiliar APIs like that. So I'm able to type char and find that kind of thing. I'm also able to just type here. If I type a capital AC, you see I'm finding stuff like attach and I'm finding replace, things that contain that substring AC. But because I use caps, it's also finding things that are camel cased with AC. So it found append char because that actually the first word of first letter of append and the first letter of char matched. So if I have some big long thing I want to search for, if I just know the first letter of each word, I can easily find that with very minimal typing. So these kind of enhancements that help you actually get your code written faster when you know what you want to do. But I'm going to say here, all right, so header dot, what I want in this case is format. And we just want to go here and do a simple format string. So I'm going to say number of arguments, %d, and I'm going to pass in the arg count here. All right? And all right, simple enough. So what I want to do now is I want to loop over the arguments. I want to start emitting them. So if I type here 4 to start typing a for loop, you notice that 4 actually comes up now in this list and has the little snippet icon that you might recognize from C# and VB. So this is also a new thing I can do in C++. I can now hit tab here and easily have this for loop typed out for me, all the sort of boilerplate of, yeah, I'm looping through, I'm incrementing stuff. I can have that written out. And I then get to plug in the components that I want. So this is what I'm used to from C#. I can say for index equals 0. When I hit tab, you see it automatically replaced index or I where it was used with what I chose to say. The less than here is going to be less than argc. And then I can hit enter and commit, and it automatically puts my cursor there inside of the braces. So, you know, this is a good way I can do that. I can also pull up the snippet list explicitly. I can hit control K X, and you see here it actually says insert snippet. Now I'm just searching through the list of snippets only, and I can get back to the same place. But the one really cool thing you can do is, let's say you already had some code, like maybe this was like a body of something I was doing once, and I suddenly wanted to start looping over and doing this multiple times. Well, I can take any bit of code I've got, select it, and hit Control K S, and this isn't insert snippet, now it's surround with. And so with surround with, I can go back to the for snippet, and when I put it in, you see it already put that code inside the snippet where it was going to put the cursor. And I can now finish fleshing this out, say index, I can say argc, and hit enter, and now I'm in here, and whatever code I had would have already been there. So okay, I'm going to delete this now, and I'm going to basically do the same thing again to output each argument. I'm going to say here, C string argument, and I'm going to format the argument. And in this case, I'm just going to output something simple. I'm going to say, all right, so for this numbered argument, here is the value. And so I'm going to output index, and I'm going to output that particular argument there. Okay, and so now I want to actually spit this out, right? So now I'm going to say here, do C out. But, you know, because I'm using Unicode, it turns out I actually want the wide C out. But because I wrote C out, I'm actually able to find both and remember, oh, I actually want to use this slightly different method. So that gives me that trigger there. And so I can send this over here. And now I got to do, let's see here, a cast to this. And I'm going to pass in our argument here. And then I'm going to end the line. Okay, and so you know now I'm outputting what I want to output to the console. And you know, I realize that I look back up, well, I formatted the header, but I never actually outputted it, so I want to copy this line up to go there. So I mean, that would be pretty easy. I could select the line and copy it. But if I just keep my cursor where it is and I don't select anything, I can just hit Control-C. And by default, if you have no selection, Control-C will just select the current line. And so now that I go back up here, I can just hit Control-V and paste that out. I didn't have to bother selecting and getting the exact bounds of the line. So now I just go back here and I change this to header. And, you know, with any luck now, if I run the program, and build it. It's going to build, go through, and it should be able to print at the top my header, and then this, right? So it's saying here number of arguments. Now, we didn't actually provide the app any arguments, so it's just going to do the sort of default argument, which gives you the path to the app. But you get the idea. Our app is actually functioning now. So, all right, well, there we go. So we saw it was able easier for me now to be able to go write this code because IntelliSense is helping me a bit more, and I'm able to find these things easier. But what else is going on here? You might notice there's more colorization and formatting going on. C++ is sort of getting more aggressive with what kind of colorization it does and the classification it does of its tokens in the editor. But you can actually even take that sort of to the next level. So, I mean, let's just, as an example here, assume I have some global variable up here, int amount equals 0. And then inside my main method, I've also said int amount equals 0. And so the one in the main method is shadowing the global I have. Not that this is the best programming practice, but you could encounter this somewhere in a code base that you're maintaining. And so let's say you have this, right? You know, and maybe this is at the top of some method where there's all sorts of other stuff going on here, maybe, you know, tens of lines of code. You finally get down here, and then amount is used, and someone's setting it to 3. And you don't remember, is this the one that's a local variable? Is this the one that's global, right? What's going on here? If you hover over amount, it's just, for now, going to just tell you it's int, right? You'd have to navigate to it to figure it out. Well, so one of the things you can do now, if we go to options and we go to fonts and colors, I can scroll down, and there's a whole bunch of C++ colors here, and so one of them is local variables. And so I can actually go here and say, all right, well, let's make local variables in C++ green. And I'll hit OK, and you can pick whatever color it is that you want. And now, when I go back up here, you see that amount is 0 here, but the local amount that we have is green, right? Or they're both 0, but this one's black and that one's green, rather. And when I come down here, the amount that I'm setting here is green. And, you know, if I was to remove this one that was shadowing the global, if I remove the local and I go down, you see it's green, but then it turns black as the classifier kicks in and realizes this is now referring to the global. Get it build, and I happen to be running it on Win8, but none of the stuff that I'm doing now is specific at all to Win8.
Hello?
Okay. So let's see. Cool. Okay, so we've seen how this works. I was able now to do, in C++, I was able to colorize things. I was able to use IntelliSense in this better way. We've now seen how C++ got IntelliSense that was a bit closer to C#, but C# is actually doing sort of the same kind of thing to give you more options and be closer to the way that other languages like C++ maybe have handled things for those who develop code in a certain way. It's a bit a little awkward. I'm trying to get my microphone here. One of the big things that's going on now is this idea of test-driven development, right, and test-first development, where what you'd first do is you write the code that you would want to be able to write, the code that should work once your app is developed. And, you know, once you have that, then you flesh out your libraries, eventually the compile errors start to go away. And so, you know, it's sort of inverted maybe from the normal process where you start building your libraries and eventually maybe you think at the end you finally create them together and build up an app. And so when you want to code that way, there's a lot of cases where today the behavior of C# might fight you. And so you imagine, let's say the very first thing I want to do, I'm going to use another little trivial app. I want to make an app that calls in some wait class that lets me block the current thread. It's not, again, the best practice, but it's just something simple we can try out. And so let's say I know I want to call this wait object. So I start typing wait. I'm going to want to make a new wait object, but I don't have it defined yet. And so I do happen to have this duplicate wait object exception in scope from somewhere in the BCL. And so I type wait, and I hit space, and suddenly C# is very ambitious and wants to complete that for me, and it says, well, you must have meant that. That's the only thing you have, the only token that actually matches the word wait. But that isn't really what I wanted at all. And so now I'd have to undo this and start saying, okay, equals new wait. And then right now it kind of like it was willing to say, all right, you have some token you've used before, it recognizes it. But now there's this weird question of when do I hit undo and when do I not hit undo? It's not a very productive experience. I'm always going to be worried that IntelliSense is going to jump on top of me. And so people who do this kind of test-first development would always complain about the level of aggressive IntelliSense in C#, right? So it matters what kind of coding style you have. So what we've offered now in C#, and this is something you can play with in 2010, is this idea of suggestion mode for IntelliSense, where IntelliSense is about giving you the options, but it isn't as aggressive about completing. So it really can support that kind of test-first workflow. And so you can activate this by hitting Control-Alt-Space, and you see that the suggestion mode button lights up here once I've done that. And so now let's try it again. I write the word wait, but you see that the IntelliSense box I have has sort of two parts now. So on the top, I have wait, and you see that as I type the token, it's actually typing it out. We call this the builder. This is you, as you're typing, making your own IntelliSense entry for the stuff that you've already written. And so as long as that's still up there, when I hit space, it's going to believe me that that's what I wanted to type. But, you know, as I'm typing wait, if I realize, oh, I actually did want this duplicate thing, I can always just go to that, right? I can hit tab, which is my typical way to force IntelliSense to actually bind to something. Or, what I find more intuitive, as I'm typing here, I can just hit down and navigate directly to that entry and then hit space and do whatever else I'd want to do. But otherwise, if I'm expecting to code this way, I can just start to write my code. And I have to explicitly be telling IntelliSense in some way when I want it to complete. So now we're going to go on and say, all right, wait W equals new. Wait. All right. And one thing you see here is we have this little, besides the squiggle, we have this little blue box that's down here. And you see that if I hover over it, I start to get a full thing here. And I can get an option to generate a class for wait. So this is that whole generate from usage idea that came about in 2010, right? This is about being able to follow this test-first workflow, create what I would want to create by actually consuming it, and then using that to generate the classes I want. And so I'm saying, all right, I assume there's a wait class. And now I can go here and I can generate it. But I don't want to have to reach for the mouse every time I want to do that. I want to stay in this code-focused workflow. So let me do this again and say, all right, I'm typing this wait. I see the smart tag there. And let me actually just make things bigger. I'm using Control-Shift-Dot to make the font size zoom in here. And so let's say I actually want to invoke that. I can just hit Control-Dot. And Control-Dot is basically the way you invoke any smart tag. So if you see one on the screen, Control-Dot is going to invoke the closest smart tag to the cursor. And so we pull this up, and I can now hit Enter to generate a class for await. You see await turns teal, and so that means the class is now existing somewhere. It's binding to a class. But it didn't generate it in this file. If I look at Solution Explorer, I see that it actually made me await.cs in another file, which is probably what I want. I don't want everything to grow and create in one file. And so here we go. So I've made that class. So now I go here, w dot, but you know, nothing's in the class yet, so it's not very interesting. So I just continue to assume that I have these members that I want to talk about. So I'm going to say, all right, w dot, in this case, do wait. That's the thing I want to do. I want to do a wait of a certain length, and in this case, I'm just going to say time span dot from seconds. So you see I'm able to go down, open this up, and say, sure, I want to do a wait that is 1 second long. And you see that even though I finished this line, I'm pretty far away from it, I still have the smart tag back from do wait, which was this method I assumed occurred. And so now when I hit control dot, I'm going to be able to generate a method stub for do wait that it's going to put into that wait class for me. And it knows that I'm passing it a time span, so it's going to give it that time span parameter. So I hit enter. Now my error goes away. And everything is now committed in here, right? So I could now go and navigate to wait.cs manually. But I'm just going to go here to do wait, my new method, and use go to definition to navigate through there. So I hit F12 to navigate through and go to definition there. And I'm now inside my do wait method. And we see that it has the parameter type that I'd expect. It made up a name for the parameter because it doesn't know exactly what semantic purpose it has. But generally, this is pretty close to what I'd want to write. So now I can go in here and I can actually implement what I want. So, you know, again, just to throw out some quick and dirty implementation, I'm just going to say thread.sleep, and I'm going to sleep for that long. So I go here to say, you know, thread dot, but I don't have thread in scope yet. I don't have a using for thread. I have the reference for it, but I don't have the using written. And so if I actually go back to thread, you see, again, I'm getting a smart tag on thread. And so I can stay on the keyboard and hit control dot, and now it's going to give me that same kind of help. It's going to tell me, hey, here's the using you'd have to add to actually make thread be in scope. And so I hit enter, and it adds using system.threading to the top of my file. So I'm staying on the keyboard, and I'm keeping that going. So now I can just type here, thread.start, or sleep, rather. And I'm going to sleep for time span. Okay, and so this is what I wanted to do, right? So now, but I can continue to improve this, right? So time span is not the best name for this parameter. Whoever's calling me when they're seeing IntelliSense, they already know it's a time span when it tells them the type of the parameter is a time span. This is not very very helpful. It's not giving much further information. So I might as well say what this is for, and I can say that this is the length of the delay. So instead of time span, I'm just going to delete this and call this delay. And you see, again, we're getting that kind of smart tag, except this one's red. So whenever you see red smart tags indicate potential refactorings that you can choose to do. So again, I hit Control Dot. It's always the same keystroke. I go there, and now it says rename time span to delay. And when I hit Enter, it actually goes about and just completes that refactoring for me. And so I've done that. And you know, it doesn't just work locally here. I can change due weight itself to say, all right, well, what if due weight should be called sleep? I change due weight to sleep, and I can do the same refactoring. Hit Control Dot, rename it to sleep. And now back in program.cs, it would have changed the name that I called it with there. But now if I want to go back to program.cs, again, I could use Control Tab or something. But remember, I got here by hitting F12. So if I want to sort of do the opposite of an F12, there's actually a separate stack that's maintained in the IDE just for go to definition. And so I hit F12 to get in there, but now I can hit Control Shift 8. And by doing that, it pulls me back to where I was. And then Control Shift 7 pulls me back in. So if you have just one of these and the tab's already open, that's probably not the easiest way to contort your hand. But you know, if you actually were digging really deep into some stack and you wanted to remember where you were, and you knew that you were using go to definition to dig in, and you were also moving around elsewhere in the code, this is a good way to snap back to the last time you did go to definition. We're going to talk later about some other stacks that they have where you can navigate backwards and forwards to places you've been. But you know, if you've been navigating and doing other things in your code, you could be gathering a lot of these places. And if you just want to go to the last place you did go to definition, you can do Control Shift 8 and it'll do that for you. And so we see we're back in the main method, and you know, we have our method. It's now properly renamed sleep for us. And so now our program is basically, you know, doing what we want it to do. So, all right, this is looking pretty good now. So let's take a look. I mean, this is sort of, again, this whirlwind kind of thing. We showed a bunch of stuff for writing and navigating code. Let's take a look at that next category of stuff. What else can we do? What can we do about making VS itself be a more productive environment for us? So I'm going to go to actually a different instance of VS right now. And what I have up here is a card game. I'm just going to run it so you can see what project we're looking at. Some of you guys might recognize this. This is like a VS 2005 starter kit we shipped. It's just a good WinForms app, something for us to play with as we're going through here. Let me hide this automatically. All right, just do like that. I'll put this on the side. And so I'm going to go here, and I can, you know, I can deal, and I can, you know, stand, and that's fine. The dealer won this time. Unfortunate. But this is basically the app. It's an app I can run through and play blackjack hands. But what do I want to do first? Let me actually put this over here. So what I want to do first is, you know, just dig in and start to look at this app and see what these files are. And, you know, if you think about the kind of stuff you do normally when you're inspecting an app, maybe a code base you're unfamiliar with, you start looking at one file and then another file. Like maybe you'd go into, you know, player here, and then you'd start digging into blackjack hand. You might have 12 there. And you'd start to gather a bunch of tabs on the top of the screen. And maybe you had three tabs you really thought were important, but now suddenly you have 10 tabs, and it's really obscured what you were doing. So one really common request we've heard on the IDE side has been better tab management. How can I keep track of the tabs I actually really care about for my work versus the other tabs? So a core thing we have now in VS 11 is this idea of a preview tab. You notice here's the one real tab I was looking at. This is the tab where maybe I've been modifying code. But as I've been clicking around, you see here if I click the state type, I have this idea of a single-click preview. I click there, and just by clicking, it actually will launch that and show that image, or show that code file, rather. And so, you know, I can do that, but I'm not actually accreting tabs as I'm doing this. It's all showing up in that one preview tab. And we share the preview tab for other purposes. If I'm in Blackjack game, a real tab I have, and I hit F12, well, it's going to navigate using that preview tab. And so it just keeps reusing this one location. And then let's say, okay, well, now I'm player. Maybe I do care about this tab. I can promote it here explicitly to be a real tab. But more likely, I'm going to be promoting it because I care about it. I'm going to be modifying it. Maybe image is going to have some new type. So as I start to type something else here, you notice it jumped to the left. And so this tab now became a real tab. So as VS notices that you really actually care about the tab, it'll start to promote it for you. But otherwise, it'll go out of its way to try to minimize the number of these sort of garbage legacy tabs that you're sort of gathering as you poke around in your code. So I'm going to put this back so things compile. So that's cool. We have preview tabs, and I'm just setting this up now because you're going to see them used a lot through the rest of the stuff I show. So let's actually go now and try to simulate this idea of multi-monitors, right? It's a little tricky when we're giving a demo, so I'm going to use actually Arrow Snap to simulate doing this. Let me actually minimize this stuff here. So this left side, just imagine, is my left monitor, and the right side, we'll imagine, is my right monitor. And so what I have over here, this is going to be my code. You know, there's not very much room like this, but we'll pretend. And what I want to do is pull something off to be on a separate monitor. So in VS 2010, we first had this idea of code windows that you could finally pull off. You could always float your tool windows, but you couldn't float your code windows before 2010. And so, like, imagine I go here and I want to take this state window and float it off, right? I could do this, and I could use, again, arrow snap. I could push windows right to snap that to the right side of the screen. And so I had the ability to do this. But one, you know, pretty important thing that we didn't have the ability to do was snap two tabs together, right? So in VS 11, we now added that. You can add a tab over here and make another sort of full document well over there on the side. But, you know, still, there's more things I want to do. What else? What if I want to, you know, actually have my own solution explorer? What if I want to carve off sort of one part of my work for one monitor and one for another, but want that benefit of being in one instance of VS? So I could see a case where I'd want to do that. I have this unit test project at the bottom. Maybe I want to keep that unit test project on the right monitor. So first of all, I'm going to get rid of the thing I have here. I'm going to control double click on the top here. That means absorb all those tabs back into the main tab well. And what I'm going to do now is just take class 1.cs. Again, I'm just single clicking here to bring these up in the preview tab. And I'm going to drag it off and say, okay, windows right, that's going to be the thing on the right here. And Solution Explorer actually has a lot of new abilities. We're going to see more of them later, but one of them is the fact that I can make extra copies of it. So if I stretch this out a bit, you'll see that I have here the ability to create a new window that contains a copy of that current view, right? So now I have two Solution Explorers, and I can go here and dock this to my right monitor. So now I have a left monitor and a right monitor in the same instance of VS, but they each have their own Solution Explorer. And I can go further and actually say, all right, well, unit test project, let me go here and filter Solution Explorer for things that this project contains. And so I click the little widget over here, I click Contains, and now I have this scoped Solution Explorer. The Solution Explorer is now only about the unit test project. And so now I have the ability to say, all right, if I double-click class 1, what happens? If I click class 2, you see this window on the right has its own preview tab. If I went over here to state, you'd see that that would open on the left, or you know, the EULA would open in a preview tab on the left. So things I do over here manifest on the right, things I do on the left manifest on the left. So I actually have these separate pseudo-instances of VS that I can think about and reason about. And so really, this gets you a lot closer to that idea of really having two separate instances of VS, but having them share all the things, having them share one open project. When I hit F5, they're both going together. I get that benefit of multiple monitors a lot more in VS 11. So that's cool. So I'm able to do all this stuff with multiple monitors. One thing, too, though, you know that there's this thing here, this sort of overflow area. And if I click there, it'll show me all the tabs that are open, including the ones that are showing, but it shows me the tabs I can get to. And so this is kind of convenient if I can click it, but I have to use the mouse to do that. Well, not necessarily. So if I hit Control-Alt down, I can bring that up with the keyboard. So if I know there's a tab that I have open and I want to get to it, I can hit Control-Alt down to get to that list. And once I'm in the list, I can start typing. So if I wanted to get to player, I could type P and it'll select that. And then I can hit Enter. Okay, so I'm able to pull this stuff apart. One other cool thing, actually, though, is if you look at the Windows 7, basically the jump lists here, or not the jump list so much, is just the tab previews. You think of how IE works, where even if you have one IE window, it's able to show you a preview for multiple tabs that you have in IE. Well, we're doing that same kind of thing now in Visual Studio, where, yes, these are technically the same instance of Visual Studio, but this has been pulled off to be its own separate thing that you want to manage, a separate document well. And so, you know, besides these other instances of VS I have, I get to show this left side and this right side as separate things inside the Windows 7 dock area here for my thing. So I'm able to say now, all right, I could do this with the mouse. You saw I'm able to switch between that. I can start to also leverage, though, the keyboard commands that are in Windows 7 itself to navigate there. So you may not know this, but if I use the Windows key, I can actually treat the icons that are on the start menu or in the taskbar as numbered icons. So I see that VS is my third icon. That's where I've pinned it. I can push Windows 3, and as long as I keep holding the Windows key, I can cycle with the keyboard through all of those windows that are open. And so if I want to switch to this one, I can do that. And then if I want to switch focus back to the other one, I can just use Windows 3 and cycle back there. So I have that ability. And you know, there's more things I can do. So you remember that if I right-click here, I could just click that to actually open another instance of VS, but I can do that with the keyboard too. I can push Windows Shift 3, and it knows open a new instance of the third program on the taskbar. And so we don't actually want this, so we'll close that down once it loads. But the other thing I can do is, when I right-click this, I get the Windows Managed Most Recently Used list. So this lets me load projects that I've used recently, and I use this a lot when I have certain projects I'm working on. And so let's say some project I cared about wasn't open. Well, I could push Windows Alt 3. Windows Alt 3, rather. And when I do that, I get this list, and I get it again with the keyboard. And so I could navigate here and hit Enter, and it would load that project. And I could get to it again without having to reach for my mouse. Cool. Okay, so we see all the cool stuff we can do with the jump list. We saw the stuff I can do moving these tab wells around. So let me actually just kill this one tab well, or this document well, sorry, over here, and take a look at one more thing we've done to help out in the IDE, which was sort of the toolbar simplification. If you've used VS 2010, you might notice there's a lot less icons on my toolbar here, and we've done that condensing. We've sort of analyzed the data. If you opt into the customer experience improvement program, you know, we see which buttons you're pushing more than other buttons. We see which buttons people just really don't click that are on the toolbar. We've taken that data and figured out how we could simplify the toolbar down to that 90% case, the things that people actually want to do, so that if you're getting used to VS and you're trying it out, you don't have so many things that are in your face that are kind of rarely used. But we know that there's probably always going to be one or two things that you did use that we've removed that you want to do get back again. So one way you can do that is you click this overflow. This is for the standard toolbar. Let's say we click here. We go to Add or Remove Buttons. And this shows the buttons that you could easily add here. Obviously, you can go to Customize and add any button you like from anywhere. But the buttons shown here are specifically the ones that used to be on the standard toolbar in previous versions of VS. So if there's that one button you're missing, it's easy for you to get it back. And one of those that some people miss is this idea of a direct find box that's up there in the toolbar. This was a cool feature we had, right? You could go here, you'd leave this in the toolbar. If you get up there, you can start typing like decimal, and you hit enter, it's going to cycle through. And we have a keyboard shortcut that actually gets you up there. So it's control slash, and then I could start typing and do this kind of search. It would search across my files. Now, there's actually a really interesting story about how a bug turned into sort of a feature with this box. So this box, like its obvious purpose is the find box. You saw when I was adding it here, that's what it's called. It's called the find box, right? But when they were adding this box in 2005, they wanted to add the ability for it to have a most recently used list. They wanted you to be able to go back and find history of the things that you've done in that box. And the way they did that was they leveraged a system that was already in place for the command window. If you've used the command window before, basically, inside the command window, actually, there it is, yep. See, I'm even forgetting the keystroke now. Control WA, that's it. When you're in the command window, basically you can execute commands here and have them execute against VS. Like I can say file dot and say open file here. And so this is a convenient way if you want to get used to certain commands you like to do to just kick them off. But we needed, this has a most recently used list. We needed one for here, so they actually use the same infrastructure. And so it has a recent find list, but it actually, by virtue of that, means that if I type that same angle, the closing angle, and I use that at the beginning, this actually becomes a command. So you see now when I'm typing file dot, I'm able to type commands right up there. And so this was sort of an accidental feature that as people started to use it and like it, we've embraced. We made it a real thing. So now here, if I go and I hit control slash, I get up there, I easily just type angle, and I can type file dot open file and hit enter and open that dialog. And to make this robust and easy, we actually have a bunch of command aliases that are programmed in that are part of it. And so, for example, open file, I just have to type OF, and then I can hit enter, and I'm able to get through there. And so this is good, but I also actually, if I hit OF space, as I start typing here, let's say I want to open the class 2 from the unit test project, there's actually even completion that occurs in here. So I can go through here and easily just jump to another file in my project, and that was control slash angle OF space, and then I'm typing the name of the file that I care about, and I'm able to get that. All right, so that's just a quick tour of the stuff you can do on the IDE side. We looked a lot at the document management and the document well management and a bit about the toolbars, including the command window. So that find box is kind of a good segue to the third section. We're talking specifically about search and also about find within documents. And so I promise I'd tell you the difference between search and find. So we'll actually go to a different instance of VS. I'm now going to use Windows 3 to cycle through these. So I'm going to go back to card game. Actually, I will stay in card game, actually. But I'm going to go to a different form in here. So I'm going to go to blackjack form. And I'm going to pull this up. It's just a Windows form. And I'm going to open the toolbox. I'm going to pin that so we can see it. And you know, for good measure, I'm going to go here and pull up the error list as well. And if we look at all these places now, again, this is VS 11, you can start to see that there's actually search boxes in many more places than we had search boxes before. Right? I guess we didn't really have any search boxes before. And so what you have the ability to do now is have this rich search experience throughout not just your code, but also throughout the IDE to let you find things easily. And so one of them is just directly over there in Solution Explorer. So you know, we think of Solution Explorer as it lists my solution, lists my projects, and lists my files. But we've actually made it go beyond that. You can see if I open up into one of these files, I now actually get the equivalent of class view within Solution Explorer now. And so inside player, it shows me there's a player type, and inside that type, there's the methods and the things that it has. And I can do this for any of these files, right? But that means then that when I'm searching Solution Explorer, so I'm going to hit Control Semicolon, which it reminds you in the IDE. It's very nice. I can hit Control Semicolon, go there. If I search for something like player, it's going to find player.vb, but it's also going to find the player class within it. It's going to find this player lose and player win method within some other file. It's going to basically find everything that's in my project that really relates to the word player. And so I can do these kind of searches and really find robustly what's going on inside my program, and I might find that one little thing I was looking for and I didn't quite remember where it was. And you can think of this as sort of the successor to Navigate To, which is still in the product. If you've used that before, you hit Control Comma, and you get Navigate To, which pops up, and I could do the same kind of thing there, type player, and it would give me this list of places that is a substring of some token, and I could easily pick one and navigate. But we think that this is actually a much better UI for that, because you're not just getting a list of things, you're getting it in the tree view, the same tree view that you use when you're navigating Solution Explorer. So you keep that spatial relationship between the different files that are part of your project. So I'm able to search for player here, and that's pretty cool. And I could do similar things like that in Solution Explorer. But I can also search other boxes too. So, you know, at this point, there's plenty of Windows Forms controls, and there's all these other categories too. But if I knew I was searching for something, I could just go here and start typing button and find it, or type text and find that, or whatever print controls that I want to find. And so knowing that I'm in there, I can just easily search for the thing I care about. And you notice there's one other one here. There's one in the error list as well. So if I actually go to, let's just say, blackjack game, and we'll hide the toolbox for now. And let me just say I add some garbage text here to add an error to it. And I'm going to do the same thing over here to state. I'm going to add some error. And so if I actually look down at the error list now, I see that there's two errors, declaration expected for both, because that's not valid code. But what I can do now, if I go down to the error list, I could actually click in there and search for errors. But I'm going to do it a different way. Let's say I'm actually already in the error list, maybe looking through these and hitting enter and navigating or something. While I'm down here, if I hit alt backtick, it's the little opposite of the apostrophe that's next to one, at least on US keyboards. If I hit alt backtick, that's going to go to that search box. And so basically, alt backtick means for whatever tool window I'm in, if that tool window has a search box, go to its current search box, whatever tool window has the focus. So I'm in there, I hit alt backtick, I can get up there. And now I'm going to say, all right, well, let's say I want to search for this. Well, if I search in here, it's actually going to search all the columns. So if I search for declaration, it's going to find everything. But if I search for state, you see it only finds the one error that's from state.vb. And I can obviously go search for blackjack game, it'll find the other error. And you see that when I filtered, it says here one of two errors. And so it's telling me how many total errors there are and how many that actually met my filter. So I know when there's more that I have to go worry about. And you know, this is me just filtering based on file, but I actually don't even have to do this to filter based on file. You see there's an extra widget over here. I can pull this down and say, all right, well, I just want to, by default, filter my error list by some criteria. I could filter it by the set of documents I happen to have open. I could filter it by the current project that I have, or I could filter it by current document. So if I say current document, you see, again, I have one of two errors, and it's telling me I'm looking at errors from blackjack game. And now, you know, if I remember where the other error was, well, it wasn't in player, but if I go to state, you see that's where the error is. It shows it to me there. So again, if I find that I make some big refactoring and maybe I have 200 errors in my program, but I really want to focus on one file at a time, I can easily do that now. I can set my error filtering to just show me the errors in the file that I happen to be looking at the moment. Okay, so I've gone through all these kind of boxes here, and we've talked about the error list. Let me actually just turn off this filter for now. And we'll get rid of these. Go back to blackjack game, we'll get rid of that. So the one other search box you see here is sort of this meta search box that's over the IDE itself. And this is the quick launch box in the upper right corner. And you see it also tells you what its shortcut key is. That's control backtick. So when I push that, control backtick, I get up there. And what I'm able to search for now is basically anything that surfaces in the IDE, any command, any option that I have, something I could want to get to, I'm able to just do that directly here. So if I say, let's say I wanted to add a new project, right, and I don't feel like fiddling with new and trying to hover my mouse all the way along this without falling off or something. And let's say I didn't actually want to devote the brain space to remembering Control-Shift-N, given how infrequently I actually make a project. But I do remember that it's called new project. I can recall that much. So I hit Control-Backtick. I can now just type new project. And it's going to do a search, and it sees, okay, well, here's this new command, our file new project. That's a command that you might want to execute. And I could maybe want to make a team project or from existing code or add a project. And so if I wanted to add a project, I'd go down here and say add one, and it's going to bring up that add project window for me. And so one interesting, useful place for this is, let's say I was in my unit test project, I'm kind of doing something here, and I say, oh, you know what, I should probably make a class to do foo or something, right? And so I could do write out foo and generate it and delete the code or something, but if I just want to make a class and I don't want to leave the keyboard, I could just, hey, control back tick add class. It brings up the add class command that's available there. I do that, and I just call it foo.cs, and that's generated now for me, and I can control tab and go back to where I was. And so I'm able to get to these commands, and you can find commands that are very easy for you to find there, maybe commands that don't have a convenient shortcut, or they're so arcane, or you use them so infrequently that you don't want to remember whatever the specific shortcut is, but this is a nice sort of fallback way you can get to anything in the IDE. And the other things you can do are not just commands, but also options, right? So imagine you want to change your colors for things. Like, so we could have gotten to change the C++ colors by just typing colors, and it'll pull us to that specific part of the options screen. And one thing I could do also is maybe I want that RSS feed that shows up on the start page to be different. So I search for RSS, and I'll hit enter. And you notice that this options page actually doesn't have the word RSS on it. We've done the work to go back to a lot of these pages, hopefully more in the future, where it doesn't have the keyword, but maybe it would be likely that you would search for that. And we've done the work to annotate it so you can easily find the thing you want to find inside options. And while we're here, one thing you can look at, you actually go to the quick launch section itself. You see, for quick launch, there's these different providers that are surfacing data into quick launch. So one of them is most recently used. This is going to be the last stuff you happen to use quick launch to go find. One of them is commands. We were using that. We were using options, and you could search for open documents too. But you can see that, well, if I know I'm searching for an option, I could actually specify this provider and filter down. So if I use some word like, I go to control backtick and I type debug, I want debug options, but there's just too much stuff called debug. It happens to be my recently used, but if it wasn't, I'd be looking at all these commands down here and debugging is all the way down there. So if I knew that I wanted an option for debug, I could actually just type at opt debug in here, and it'll filter only for the options provider. But that requires you to remember that add opt thing. It's actually an even easier way. If I get up here and I start typing debug, and I see that there's all these categories and I want to go to a different one, well, just hit control backtick again. And you see it'll tell you that over at the bottom. Every time I hit control backtick, it actually cycles through which of these views it's showing me. And so once I get to the one that I want, there I am. Maybe I want edit and continue, so I hit down to go to that, and then that's the result that I have. And so I'm able to use quick launch. I'm able to go in, scope my results, and navigate pretty smoothly there. So, all right, that was search. So we have a good sense of search. Search is sort of about looking in the IDE more so than your actual text of your code. But now let's figure out what we've done for find, right? What does VS 11 give you for find, and the actual core search experience in the IDE? So again, I'm going to use Windows 3. I'm going to rotate around to the Mandelbrot demo. We're going to see more of this later, but we're just going to use it now to do some finding. And I'm going to go here and say Control F. And what I'm going to do is search for a dispatcher. And you can see dispatcher, this is a UI app, so you might expect that it interacts with the dispatcher a lot. And so I have dispatcher showing up here a bunch. But you saw when I hit Control F, I didn't get that sort of quick find box that you get in VS 2010. I got something that looks a lot more like what you'd expect from whatever your favorite browser is, where you get the little nice inline find experience up at the top. And so I do that. I type dispatcher. And it's also, as I'm typing it, it's incremental. I don't have to get all the way there. If I see that it's highlighted what I want and put me there, I can stop typing as soon as I notice that. And so this is great. I'm finding dispatcher. But let's say I actually just want to find dispatch. I'm trying to look for the word dispatch. And so I don't really want to find all these things that match dispatcher. And so in that case, maybe I'd want to go do some kind of regular expression query. And so how many of you guys have tried to do regular expression queries today with find? So a few. So the regular expressions that you actually have to use if you go to do that in find today are these POSIX regular expressions. And it's not the actual regular expressions you're used to from .NET. So for those who actually did venture there, you end up having to learn some entirely separate set of regular expressions. And people will post on forums. It's one of the most common complaints, like, hey, I'm trying to use regular expressions, and this doesn't work, even though I just tested it in .NET. And so we finally retired those POSIX regular expressions. So now if you go here and you type dispatch, you go down here, and so I can hit Alt down to bring up this list when I'm in the find box, Alt E to turn on regular expressions, and then Escape to close that. And so now I'm searching for dispatch, and now this is going to be the beginning of my regular expression. So the other frustrating thing, at least that I found, when trying to use regular expressions in find, is that especially if I'm not doing string manipulation all day, I don't necessarily remember all the syntax for it. So I'm kind of poking around trying to figure it out. And as I'm trying to figure it out, you kind of write the whole thing, and then you say, hey, maybe this is right, and you hit find, and it says there's no results. And you kind of poke it again, and you see, hey, does this work? So, but now, just like you get, as I'm typing dispatch, I'm getting that incremental search that's happening. I can also go ahead and start doing stuff for my regular expression. So let's say I want to say, all right, the next character should be any character except an E, I'm trying to filter out dispatcher. So let's say I say, oh, well, I know I kind of want to capture the character, so I'm going to use parens maybe. And I remember that you say like caret E or something to say that it's not an E, but I do that and it still doesn't work. So I said, I'm thinking a little more. Oh, wait, so maybe I put it in brackets. And then as I am actually putting it in brackets, the moment that I get it right, it suddenly snaps to the result. So as you're editing it at every step, it's doing that live search for your regular expression. And you can immediately validate when you have it right. And importantly, once you do have it right, as you're typing the rest of it, you know exactly what keystroke makes it wrong again, because suddenly you'll have zero results. You can undo whatever that very last thing is that you did and then figure out exactly what to do. So I find it far easier to form the correct regular expression even this way. So now I found this, and you see basically I'm finding dispatch with a paren and dispatch with an angle bracket. So now if I want to replace all these and replace it with some other token, I need to be able to preserve that last token that I found. So I'm in Control F right now. If I hit Control H to switch to replace, I see I get a replace box also. I can tab down to the replace box. And let's say I want to replace the word dispatch with the word invoke. So I'm going to say here invoke. And I put parens in my regular expression on the first line. What that enables me to do is capture that character that was there, that one character that wasn't an E. And I want to reinsert that back when I replace, so I don't want to lose it. So what I can say here is $1. And that's going to mean match the first thing that I put parens around in the find expression. And now, I still want to double check that this is right, so I'm going to hit Alt-R to replace just one of these. And I saw that it worked. It replaced that one. That looks like what I want to do. So now I hit Alt-A to just replace all of them, and I see that, look, the invoke with parens kept its parens, the invoke with angle brackets kept that, so everything is good. But if I go back up here, I see all the things that said dispatcher instead of just dispatch stayed the same. So I got it to do what I wanted it to do with my regular expression. I was able to see along the way exactly that I was doing the right thing. I got rich, real-time feedback, which is sort of critical unless you're very into regular expressions very often. So I did this now. I've seen find. I've seen replace. What about find in files? What if I want to find more than in just the current file that I'm in and I want that kind of list of stuff that I'm used to? Well, you might be used to going to find in files by going to find and kind of clicking find in files in the dialog. Well, there's always actually been a keystroke that gets you directly there. You may not know about it. So Control F gets you here. Control Shift F gets you to find in files. So we still have the little floaty find replace box, but now it's only for find in files. And if you hit Control Shift H, that'll get you to replace in files. So I go to find in files, and I'm going to say here, all right, no more regular expressions. Maybe just search for the word dispatch throughout. And we see, all right, well, here, it found dispatch, but, part of this is because I'm on a large font, but you can see that it actually went off the edge. The code that I have here is not fitting on the screen, right? Most of this is taken up by a path, which is probably not too relevant to me. So what I really want to do is maybe filter that path out, just kind of show the file name, give myself something more meaningful. So if I'm coding on my laptop, I have the ability to see the lines that I'm finding. So what I'm going to show you now is sort of the most wacky out there feature I'm going to show. It's actually not an officially supported feature of VS, but it's something one of our testers sort of discovered. at some point that some dev had left in. And it's the ability to change the find experience there and what actually you output when you do find in files. And this requires everyone's favorite tool, regedit. So this actually comes with all standard disclaimers. Regedit may eat your children and blow up your computer and your house and everything. But if you actually follow along here, hopefully it won't do that. So basically, you just go in here, you go to current user, you go to software, you go to Microsoft. Hopefully this should all be expected. You go to Visual Studio, you go to 11, and then there's this find path that's in there. And when you go to the find path, you see some stuff here, like the stuff we've been finding in that find box. But also, you can add one more thing here. I can add a string value, and it's going to be called find result format. And so I type that in there, and I actually do not remember what the find result format is because it's complicated, so I just sort of keep it here. It's allowed to, you're allowed to cheat at least once in your demo. And then I'm going to paste that in there, right? And so, and you can see what it's doing. You can imagine. I'm going to use this. It's a bigger font, right? So you're saying that, all right, these are variables I'm going to substitute in. This is the file name. This is the extension, $E. This is the line number here, right? But the one thing I'm leaving out is the path. I'm not pulling in that huge, long path that I don't really care about. And so I'm going to just keep that. Click OK. And now I'm going to go back to VS, and I'm going to close this or clear out the results here. I'm going to do another Control-Shift-F, and this time I'm going to search for it. And you see that now I only have the file name there. And so I'm able to get these really awesome results and not have to dig through all that path stuff along the way. So that's sort of a use-at-your-own-risk kind of thing you can do there. All right. So now I've customized my search, my find experience. I've poked around through the IDE, through my code. So let's actually dig in. Remember, we said the last thing we cared about a lot was the debugging experience and getting really proficient and efficient when we're doing debugging. So to do debugging, let's actually go back. We're going to use Windows 3 again. We're going to go back to the card game demo. And I'm actually going to use I'll do this first. I'm going to say control semicolon. I'm going to go over to Solution Explorer. I want to find deal new game. And so I type deal new game. I know this is a method in there. So it's there. I can hit enter and I navigate directly to it. And so now I'm over here in deal new game. And I just want to take a look at how this works, right? So maybe this is a method I want to investigate. So what kind of stuff would you do today if you want to poke through a method, debug through it, see what it's doing? You'd probably set a breakpoint on it, hit F9, and hit F5, and run until you get there. But you know, then you kind of leave a breakpoint around. If you get distracted and do something else, then there's a breakpoint over there, and you kind of have these like five random breakpoints over your program. What you really want to do is just go to that code. You don't really care to persist a breakpoint. You just want to go there right now. So a feature we have is, this is a feature we've had for a while, it's called Run to Cursor. And run to cursor just basically means set a temporary breakpoint, and then once we get there, or if we don't get there, then just cancel. It's the best effort to actually get to that line and then stop. And so I'm going to go here. I'm going to hit Control F10. And Control F10 is going to put this sort of little temporary breakpoint there, and it's going to run the app. And so I'm going to hit New Game. And then I'll make a bet, and I hit Deal. And when I hit Deal, you see we hit this point here, right? And now if I ever got here again, it wouldn't stop. It was a one-time breakpoint. But it got me to where I wanted to go, and I don't have to go manually turn this breakpoint off at this point. So now I can step through here. I'm stepping through. I'm using F10, right? And I can use other things. I can use F11 to step in. Maybe I don't care about shuffle anymore, so I use Shift F11 to step back out without having to step through the whole body of shuffle. And so now I can keep doing F10. I make a new hand. I make stuff here. But you know, I really want to just get down to here. So I can use Control F10 again within my method to just say run to cursor and get me down to here, and it executed all the code in between. And so now let's say I hover over player, and I look and say, all right, well, what does player have? Player has a hand. I look at the hand, and the hand has cards. And you know, maybe for whatever kind of debugging I'm doing, it's like, oh, well, that's two face cards. It's not going to do. I need to, the guy to have a worse hand or something. And so you know, let's say I want to just go back up here and draw two more cards. Well, you can think of IntelliTrace or some of these things and rolling back, but you don't actually even need to do anything that fancy. If all I really want to do is just put the instruction pointer back up there, I'm able to do that. So you see here, the cursor changes when I get here, and it tells me to change which statement's executed next, I can just drag the arrow. So if I just drag hold of this yellow arrow here, and I put it up here, well, now suddenly we're up here again, right? And you know, this didn't rewind time the way that IntelliTrace would. It simply set the next statement to execute within the current method. And so now it's as if I'm just doing this again. So I'm saying, all right, player gets a new hand, dealer gets a new hand, I'm doing this kind of stuff. I can come down here, hit Control F10 again, and now when I go to player, and I hover over it, and I go in, and I can see what's the hand, and then what's the cards in the hand. You see, now we have different cards. Maybe these cards are better suited to whatever scenario that I'm debugging. Okay, so that works, right? And so I can, you know, I can see how that benefits me. And by the way, if I want to do that, I can say Control-Shift-F10. That's the keystroke that actually does it if I don't want to drag the arrow. So let's actually set a real breakpoint here and hit F5. And there is a really cool thing that you can do here. Now let's say I want to debug, right? I want to go into player, and there's something I care about here, and you know, maybe I care about the player's balance, right? But I don't really want to set a watch. I could set a watch to track the player's balance every time I hit this breakpoint, but maybe I do actually have 10 breakpoints that I'm tracking all over the place. Every time I look at the watch window, I just am going to see all of these different breakpoint or all these different values that could be evaluated, and half of them are not going to be in scope, and you know, it kind of works, but it's not as neat as what I want. What I really want is something that's kind of spatially scoped to where I am. I'm looking at this line of code. I really want watch things that are specific to this line of code. And so I have the ability now to do that. If I hover here over player, and I dig into player, and I say, all right, balance, this is something I care about, you see I can go over here and I can pin this thing over here on the right. And so by clicking the pin, you see that suddenly in the editor window, I get this little widget that shows up, which is a pinned data tip. And so this is now showing me, all right, well, that player's balance is going to show up here. And you notice, though, it's not just some weird thing floating. Like, as I scroll, it actually scrolls with my code. If I was to close this, right, and go to control, semicolon, and go back to, deal new game, and hit enter, and come back here, when I scroll down, that's still there. So it's sort of glued to my code file in that position. But what it does is give me this ability to know about that value without polluting my watch window. So whenever I'm back here at this breakpoint, I can see it. And it behaves just like anything else you'd have in a watch, right? So I hit F5. We get back into the UI. I'm going to say, all right, I have 20. So I'm going to stand. Oh, it was a push. Okay. Well, I'm getting brave now, so I'm going to bet a whole bunch, right? So I just bet a whole bunch of money, and now I have less money because I bet a lot of it. And so I'm down to 26.50, right? So you see it turns red because it changed. The value changed, and it's telling me that. So I have all the same abilities I have in the watch window to track what's going on, but you could imagine now I'm sprinkling these throughout my code, and I have this kind of locality. I'm able to put these in the place where they're actually relevant and next to the thing that I would actually potentially want to go investigate further and keep that kind of spatial awareness of my code. So that's cool. I got my pinned data tips now. The one thing here is actually if I, you know, let's say I decided here, okay, the player's balance is not what I expect, or maybe the hand isn't what I expect, I want to dig into the new hand. I can do this kind of thing, right? I'm able to say F11 to dig into new hand. If I keep hitting F11, step into, I'm going to dig into new blackjack hand. I'm starting to step into this stuff, right? But let me just set that again back up here. I'm stepping into here. I step in, like, say, two levels deep, right? Now, this wasn't F12. I can't use that Control-Shift-8 thing. But this is just a place that I've gone to in my preview tab, and I want to back up out of it. So you see the one thing that we did retain on the toolbar as part of the simplicity effort, we actually kept this idea of navigate backwards and navigate forwards. And we've even simplified it a bit. And we really want this to be a core way that people use VS, that you guys go and actually think about where you are. You should be able to think of it the kind of way you think of a browser, that I'm going through kind of a sequence of places in VS, and I can always just easily go backwards and forwards in that sequence and not have to remember exactly the name of the place I was to go find it again. So I dug all the way in here with F11, but now if I hit Control minus, I'm able to go back to the method I was just in. If I Control minus again, I can go back there. If I hit Control Shift minus, I can dig forward. So Control minus and Control Shift minus dig in the opposite directions. And if I use the UI, if I pull this down, what you see is it looks just like a browser, right? It has a list of these past places I've been, and I can go back and I can pick one. And then if I go back to it again, you see that this one down here is checked off, and I could actually go forwards again by picking something higher in the list. If you use this experience in VS 2010 or earlier, it's a little more complicated. You pull it down, it shows kind of all the files that you've had locations in, and then within each file, it tries to give you this most recently used list. It's harder to actually figure out between the files where you actually were, and that's usually the thing that you're most concerned about. How do I get back to the other file I was in? So we think we've actually tried this out. We think this is a much easier experience to use than the other one. Okay, so now we can go backwards and forwards like that. And we've seen how we can debug here, how we can step into, we can set these data points, or these pinned data tips. So let's actually go now to sort of the last demo. We're going to go into, use Windows 3 again, go over to the Mandelbrot demo, and we've actually been poking around in it, but we haven't run it yet. So let's see what it does. I'm going to run this, and it has build errors. Oh, because we renamed all this stuff. So, yes, we do not actually want this to be called dispatch. So I'm going to search for control here. I'm going to search for the thing I called invoke. And I'm going to undo inside this method. And again, each file has its own undo stack. So once I find the file and it was still open, I can just hold undo in that file. So now I'm going to hit control F5. This should work now. So here we go. We have this fractal generator. It's called Mandelbrot. We've cleverly misspelled Mandelbrot so that we don't get sued by his estate or anything for showing fractals. But what we can do here is I can dig in, right? You know, and this is going to do tasks in the background. It's scheduling this work in parallel, doing a bunch of cool stuff. And you can kind of get distracted just continually doing this. But basically, we're able to dig in here, and it's just rendering fractals for us, and it's letting us interact with the UI. And the sort of different core places where important logic is going on here. So I'm going to navigate to, what's the file it is called? Actually, let's just find fill color. I'll do that later. So I'm going to go here and say fill colors, fill color lookup. We're going to end up over here. And you can see, remember it was kind of the psychedelic colors going from black to purple to red to yellow. This is the thing where you set the colors you want. And then you see this method here is going to take those starting colors and kind of generate all the interpolated colors in between and use that as the color ramp. Okay, so now we've got this. This kind of makes sense. But let's actually see. What if we care to debug these colors, right? So I'm going to go here and hit Control F10. We're going to run until we get there. And so now we're there. And now I want to investigate this. So I hover over final colors. I kind of look through here. And it says, all right, results view. Well, you often have to execute results view manually. So I click that. But now it says, this expression causes side effects, will not be evaluated. I mean, it turns out that final colors is actually implemented with an iterator, and it's an iterator that calls other iterators. And it turns out the COR can't get enough safety to actually decide it's safe to do that in the expression evaluator within a data tip. The data tip has a very high threshold for what it's going to accept because it doesn't really want to have things you do in the data tip hang the UI of VS. And so we can't do this here, and so that's kind of a bummer. I really want to see what my colors are. So what else can I do? Well, I know I can hit Control-Alt-I and go to my immediate window, which everyone should become friends with their immediate window. And I can go in here, and I can start to do interesting things here, right? And I can type final colors, right? But that's not very interesting. It's just kind of shows me some stuff about it. It shows me basically that it's an I-enumerable and has some things I don't care about. What I really want to do is be able to enumerate it and get its values. And so if I think about how I often interact with things that are enumerable, I run link queries over them. And so I can start to use the link methods that are defined. I could use toArray, for example. Hit enter, I'll run this, right? And there's a lot of stuff that it's crunching here, and it's doing it all through the debugger, which is a bit slower. But you see, it ultimately gets out here 100 of these things, right? And I could hit enter and get some more. Or just tells me that there's more. But I could say here, what if I want to hit up to show the same thing again? Final colors dot, let me just say take 10, right? So this is more link sequence operators. I just want the first 10. I want to convert those to an array. Or, maybe I want to, skip the first 30, and then I want to take 10. So now, and then I want to take 10. And so I'm getting that. And so now let's say maybe if for whatever reason, these are the colors that I know I want to operate on. And so now I can, hit up, copy this to the clipboard, and now I can go use something I want to explore, right? Because this just kind of shows me this. It's in text form. But I can now hit Shift F9, which takes me to the quick watch. And inside here, if I paste this expression, it was actually already there. It actually knew I wanted it from the clipboard. Now I go here, and I can start to expand this. And now I can dig into these colors. And so maybe there was some specific thing about the color object that I cared about. So I can kind of use the immediate window to craft and explore different queries. Once I figure out what I want, I can hit Shift F9, bring it to the quick watch window, and then poke around with it as if I had a nice data tip to that particular query. And this will let me do things that are beyond what the results view can do, because I can start to shape the further result by doing more of these query operators afterwards. And so this is cool. It gets me what I want. I'm able to evaluate through here. And and one more thing that's worth noting, in the immediate window, the immediate window is another one of these command-like windows where if I hit angle bracket, I could start to do commands again. So I could, do CLS to clear this out, or if I really wanted to, I could say open file and, start loading different files here, even from the immediate window. So one last thing. So while we're here, I'm going to just say one final way to demonstrate that you can navigate within your code. We've kind of poked at a lot of different ways to navigate in your code today. But that up here we have these drop-downs. And the dropdown on the left, let me actually get back to this file. The dropdown on the left shows you different types that are in your file, and the dropdown on the right shows you the methods within that type, whatever you selected. But you can actually get there from the keyboard. So if I know that I'm in this file and I want to go up, I could say, all right, Control F2. And then I get up here, I could tab over. And then now that I tab over, if I hit Alt down, I can see all this stuff that's here. And whether I hit Alt down or not, if I know that I want to go to, in this case, Render Chunk. So I go to Render Chunk and hit Enter, and I can now navigate there. So still yet another way you can poke around your code. And so here we go. So now I'm inside Render Chunk. And you know, this is where the heart of the algorithm is. This is going and actually rendering one of those phases. It sort of progressively gets more detailed. And you know, I already have stopwatch code here that's measuring the performance from beginning to end. I might want to kind of see what's going on here. Maybe some of my phases are taking too long. So if I come down, I could say, all right, well, let me maybe do like a control F10. Actually, let me make a real breakpoint. Here, I'm going to hit F5. And all right, let's use our newfound abilities. Right? I'm going to use stopwatch. I'm going to say elapsed. I'm going to make a pinned data tip. Oop, clicked it twice. Make a pinned data tip here. So this is me here. The first stopwatch took here, it was like 0.01 seconds. If I do it again, it takes like, you know, 0.02 kind of. It's going a little bigger, right, because it's getting more details, what I expect. 0.02 again, and then, you know, it's getting more. Now it's 0.04, and then there's this kind of 3/10 of a second, that little final phase where it gets really detailed. All right, you know, and then if I dig in here, I can zoom in, and, you know, it's going to keep doing this. I can do it again. But, you know, it's kind of annoying. I have to keep hitting F5 and sort of observing what's going on. And I really kind of want, like, a log of this, right? So if I think, all right, well, pinned data tips are useful, but maybe this isn't exactly where I want them. But what do I want to do? I don't really want to have to stop my program. Maybe I've been navigating through this fractal for a while, and I found a part where I have some sort of anomaly in my program. I don't want to have to go back, add some printf debugging to my program, and then come back in and find the same place in the fractal where I happen to be. So, you know, just like I can do this kind of investigation in the moving of my instruction pointer and do that kind of active manipulation of my program, I can also do this kind of thing for tracing data as well. So you see I have this breakpoint here. I'm actually going to get rid of this tip. Well, I'll keep it for now. And I'm going to say here, at this breakpoint, well, this is a place where I care about stopwatch.elapsed. So if I right-click on the breakpoint, you may not have known there's actually a menu here that you can do all sorts of fun things to your breakpoints, like have them hit trigger every 10th time or trigger only if there's some condition. But one thing you can do is say, all right, well, when the breakpoint is actually hit, go ahead and print a message. And so I can say, all right, print this message. And the message would be, all right, chunk completed. And but specifically, I care about, you know, time elapsed. And I can now put an expression in here. If I put braces, I can specify an expression that I want to trace. And so if I move this, I saw that the expression I want to trace is stopwatch.elapsed. And then you see here, there's also other stuff. You could track call stacks if you want. You could track thread IDs. It's sort of interesting to track the thread ID because this work's kind of happening on a few different threads. You might as well do that. And so here we go. So I'm going to track this now. And you see that when I checked off print a message, it also checked off continue execution. So obviously, most breakpoints will break when you hit them. But if I'm actually making one of these things I'm using for tracing, I might not actually want to break. I probably just want to keep going and keep gathering my tracing data. So I'm going to leave continue execution checked. And I hit OK, and you see my breakpoint turns from a circle into a diamond. So now I have this special kind of breakpoint. It's called a trace point now. And so, okay, now I've got this. I'm going to be able to run this. I go back to my UI. Again, we're still where we left off. We didn't have to stop the program or anything to add printf debugging statements. I can navigate further into the fractal. And you see it goes, it resolves, goes through its thing. But now if I go to the output window, you see that I was able to output these chunk completed messages to the output window. And I didn't have to modify my program to do that. I was able to do this at debug time in the context of my debugging session. I didn't have to start merging that debugging logic into my code itself. One other little interesting trick, though, with the output window, you see here there's a bunch of other stuff here that maybe I don't quite care about as much as the actual output stuff I want. Things like when threads exit, things like the fact that I'm stepping into things, I may or may not care about that. You can go to debug options and find ways to turn this off. The other thing you can do is just right-click on the background of the output window, and it shows you all these things you probably don't care about. And so I can right-click on step filtering. I don't care when that happens. I don't care if modules are loaded and unloaded. I don't care when my threads exit. Right? And so now if I clear this out and I go back to my UI, it's one of these. We'll find out. We'll just do both of them to be safe. There we go. See, now I get my chunk completed messages. I don't get all that other info that I didn't really care about. So now I'm able to filter down to just the output stuff I like. And then just one last fun thing. You know, I have this, this point here, but now it's more than just a location, this trace point that I made. If I was to go down here and click that, or if I was to go here and hit F9, because, hey, maybe I don't want to hit this trace point right now, it would delete it. And if I hit F9 to put it back, I just get a plain vanilla breakpoint again. So what I really want to do, I don't want to delete the breakpoint when I don't want it. I really want to just disable it. And so if I go here and hit Control F9, Control F9 just enables me to disable it. You see it becomes this hollow breakpoint. So now it's a disabled breakpoint. And if I go to up here, I go to Debug Windows, I can do Control DB to go to breakpoints, right? So I can hit Control DB and bring this up. You see I have this list of breakpoints that I've got. And this one is, you know, hollow, and I can check it off centrally here. So you could have this set of breakpoints that you kind of turn on and off to test different things. And you can even actually save these breakpoints to XML and kind of load them back later. If you have different regimes you use for debugging this or debugging that, you can keep these breakpoint sets available. So you can do this kind of rich breakpoint, not just breakpoint, but also rich trace point debugging. All right, so that's the last thing I have here to show you guys. If we go back here into the slides, just again to let you know, if you get these slides later, they're going to be up on the web. You have the ability to go check out this reference section. Really, all the stuff we talked about today is here, and it's broken into those four sections in kind of the order we did it. And so you can check all these out. Go ahead, try this stuff out. A lot of these things work in VS 2010, but if you're feeling adventurous, go find a VM or a box where you can install the VS 11 developer preview if you haven't already, and go try this stuff out there. And just basically, if you're kind of interested in these kind of tips and tricks, this was really a very dense outpouring of tips, right? But if you want to track this stuff regularly, you can go check out some of these blogs. Zane has a blog. Scott Cate has a blog where they kind of just on a regular basis will publish more and more of these tricks that you can keep track of, track and see, hey, here's something new that I want to do in the IDE. I'll try it out, and it comes at a regular pace. And always just check the Visual Studio blog anyway. We have good stuff there. All right, cool. Thanks for coming.